Welcome back. This is Inside His Capital. I'm Pierre Daly. There's a teenager somewhere right now who just discovered a band exists because the album had a parental advisory sticker on it. There's a guy three beers into watching a hockey game who's heard the word odds referenced more times than the score. And there's someone who just opened their banking app to find a $96 fee attached to a 45-cent shortfall. Three completely different moments. Same underlying machinery. My guest today has spent the last few months and years, I would add, writing about the psychology sitting underneath all of this, why warnings sometimes do the opposite of what they're supposed to do, why your memory of how your portfolio did last year is probably wrong in a very specific and predictable direction, and why making an AI sound more like a human being might be the worst thing you could do to someone's investing behavior. Dr. Preet Banerjee is a personal finance expert, the force behind Money School, and a fixture of Canadian financial media, and lately in his Globe and Mail column, kind of a one-man behavioral economics lab. We're going to spend this conversation in that space between what people think they're doing with their money and what's actually steering the wheel.
This is Inside His Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Preet, welcome. It is terrific to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Pierre. Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you again for joining us on the show. First of all, before we get started, Preet, how have you been? What have you been up to most recently? I think you mentioned in our pre-chat that you had moved. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I moved to London, England about 4 years ago for love. My wife's career is based here. She's a banker by day, but she's a stand-up comedian by night. So if anyone likes comedy, yeah, at Cheryl Hurst Comedy on Instagram. Yeah, she's about to do her second full Edinburgh Fringe show this year. So in the month of August, for people who don't know, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is the largest performing arts festival, I believe, in the world. And for 30 days in August, it's nothing but performers, comedy, plays, you name it. And so she's going to be doing that again. So this will be her second full year. So I moved here so that we could be together full time. We were long distance for 5 years, but all my work is still in North America. And I've been pretty busy lately. The latest big project I've been working on is called AdvisorAppStore.com. So I do a lot of work on commercial applications of behavioral finance and also AI in the last couple of years. And so we stood up this company that actually creates these bespoke little apps for financial professionals. So if anyone's interested and wants a specific ad built for them, check out AdvisorAppStore.com. There's a little button you can request a specific app to be built and we will build it for you.
That's really cool. You sound really busy. Your wife sounds extremely busy as well. Between the day gig and the night one, you know, stand-up comedy is a tough gig to take up, you know, particularly as a sideline, something people really underestimate. I'm wondering who's keeping who busier.
Well, I'll tell you, she tackles it as seriously as any profession. You know, I often come home and she's paused a stand-up comedy special because she's writing notes about different parts of every joke. She's performing, I would say, between 3 to 4 nights a week, every single week consistently. She hosts joke writing workshops with other comedians. So just like with anything, there is a bit of a science to it, but comedy, of course, is very much an art. So it's a tough thing, but she's putting 100% effort into it. And, you know, she's had some great success. She's been on one of Jimmy Carr's show on Comedy Central UK. So for people who know, Jimmy Carr is a huge, huge comic, especially in the UK, but also globally. So we both have fairly busy. She's much busier than I am. I have a lot more downtime than she does.
Amazing. Amazing. That's truly amazing, Preet. Well, wonderful to have you. And I'm just thinking back to the last time we had you on our other show on Raise Your Average. That had to be longer than 4 years ago, it had to be before you moved, right?
You know, I don't think so. I think it was after I moved, because I think that was within the last 4 years. I think maybe I just didn't mention that I had moved.
Well, you know, I mean, given the way, you know, distributed work has really unfolded since the pandemic, I mean, it almost doesn't even matter where people are. You know, checking in is so easy now and so taken for granted that you can be anywhere you want and do what you do.
Yeah,
and especially in your case.
Yeah, and that's made it possible for me to move to the United Kingdom, and I'm really glad I did. It's such a great new experience. The culture, the food, being on the doorstep of the rest of Europe, it's been fantastic. So I don't mind the odd long commute from time to time. The funnier thing about it is that I see my friends and family in Canada way more than when I lived in Canada. So every time I go back, it's now a purposeful, intentional visit with friends and loved ones. So it's been fantastic.
Yeah, that's actually not hard to imagine, because you're concentrating your time when you do visit, and you do actually, like a lot of friendships, you know, you pick up where you left off, you know, once a year or twice a year over a coffee or dinner or something. But if you're flying in and you're visiting, you really do get to spend a lot more time, because you don't have anything else to do while you're here.
Right. And when people come to London, you know, they always stay with us, because getting a hotel in London is incredibly expensive. I will say that living in central London even makes Toronto, Vancouver feel cheap by comparison, which is such a weird thing to say. But it's great, because we spend so much time together when they're here or when I'm back in Canada.
Thanks for sharing all of that, by the way. You didn't have to, and it's really great.
My pleasure.
Reading through some of your recent work, which I enjoyed, I have to imagine it must have been quite a bit of fun to poke around some of those psychological potholes. And it's not like the first time you've done it, but you've been at it for some time. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, the evolution. I mean, for those who aren't familiar with you, the evolution of your work in finance and notably personal finance.
Sure. Well, listen, I originally trained to become a neuroscientist in university. That was my undergrad degree. And after I graduated that, realized I did not want to become a neuroscientist. And I went to an auto racing school to try and become a professional race car driver. Ran out of talent and money, so I ended up in finance. And so I started as an advisor, first a mutual fund rep and then a stockbroker at one of the big five brokerages in Canada. I can say that my career has kind of been defined by the fact that I've never really had a five-year plan. And I did know that I didn't like doing the same thing over and over again. And so for me, I spent some time as a wholesaler, product designer, bounced around the industry for a while. And at the time when I was an advisor, I was one of the first bloggers, personal finance bloggers in Canada. So early that when I told compliance about my blog, their first question was, what's a blog? That's how long ago it was. And it was one of the best and worst things that ever happened to me, because it got me into a lot of trouble from, you know, the corporate public affairs department, realizing that I was giving my unfettered opinion about whatever I wanted without oversight. And at the same time, a lot of people read my stuff and were interested in, using me as their advisor. And it led to a bit of a media career. So I did a lot of work, both in news and lifestyle TV. So in the news, I was on CBC's The National with Peter Mansbridge for 10 years doing what was called the Bottom Line panel. So it was a 20-minute economic panel. This is around the time of the Great Financial Crisis. And huge exposure. I also at one point had a television show on the Oprah Winfrey Network. So that's the lifestyle reality stuff.
Right.
And as that media stuff was taking off, I realized, all right, so I can maybe transition from, you know, the 9-to-5 and being licensed and move more into the media world. And after a while, I went back to school and pursued a doctorate. My dissertation was all about the value of financial advice. And I've been a consultant to the wealth management industry for almost 15 years now, I think. It's been a long time, and I've specialized in commercial applications of behavioral economics, so going back to the neuroscience a little bit, and tying that specifically into the wealth management business. And then lately, more work in artificial intelligence and just the value of advice in general. And yeah, there's still a lot of questions and curiosity that I have. And I think that's sort of dovetailed with my Globe and Mail column, where I get to sort of geek out on some of the latest research that's out there that impacts how people make decisions about money, and also how the wealth management industry can also use that that knowledge to further increase the value of advice in relationships. So yeah, I've been around a block and worn a lot of different hats.
That's putting it mildly. I think, you know, I mean, those are all these areas that you've delved into profoundly are super relevant to, you know, investors, but especially also to advisors. And, you know, we on this show, we've spent a lot of time digging into those areas as well. One thing that's remarkable about this business, about the financial, you know, the investment advice business, the financial business, is that, you know, there's no shortage of things to talk about. And it, you know, it's the kind of work where you realize that the more you know, the more you learn, you realize how little you actually know.
Yeah.
You know, in my personal case, I spent 15 years as an advisor, and I realized a year after I had sold my book to another advisor that I had known virtually nothing about the bond market. What I thought I knew, I thought I had a comprehensive understanding of what was going on in the bond market, what it was to investors. But when I stepped away from that lens, that advisor lens, and looked back at what I actually knew in relation to what I should have known, or what I, you know, the like, here's what I knew, and here was the you know, the sphere of knowledge that was actually important. You wake up and you realize, you know, how little you know. You know, that always brings me to the quote from Socrates, is the greatest wisdom is realizing that you have none. I'm misquoting Socrates, but I'll get it right.
And well, you know, that reminds me of one of my favorite sayings was, I think it's referred to as the Feynman test. So Richard Feynman was this world-renowned physicist. A lot of people thought, you know, one of the smartest people ever. And the Feynman test was basically... an indicator of how smart you were was how quickly you realized that he was smarter than you. And so the faster you come to that realization, the smarter you are.
Yeah. I had to take the liberty while you were saying that. The Socrates quote is, the only true wisdom is in knowing you know nothing.
Mm.
You recently wrote about a study where people's confidence in a financial decision kept climbing every time they got a new piece of information, even when that information was completely neutral and shouldn't have moved anyone's confidence at all. What was it about that finding that made you want to write about it?
Well, you know, in terms of my Globe and Mail columns, the process that I follow is I do a scan of all the recent articles that have been published in a variety of journals that I follow. There's about 15 or so that I kind of scan every 2 weeks. And I look for ideas, just a little kernel of something that sounds kind of interesting that would be relevant to either personal finance or wealth management. And I thought this one was great because, you know, confidence and overconfidence in particular is something that we talk a lot about in this business. And it has a pretty profound impact on people's results, especially when it leads to making decisions and having suboptimal returns. So when I saw this article, that's what intrigued me, in that it's very relevant to, you know, decision-making in general and investing, and also working with advisors or not, because one of the shifts that we've seen in the last while is just an explosion in how many do-it-yourself accounts have been open. That really was a hockey stick moment when the pandemic hit and the lockdowns hit. People had a little bit more cash because they couldn't spend it because they couldn't go out. And at the same time, it was a couple of things. People were spending money on gambling and sports betting, but all those games stopped because of lockdowns. And so they wanted to bet on stocks. And so this created this new sort of generation of investor that most people call a speculator as opposed to investing. And so when I saw this study looking at this confidence information cycle that can happen, I was very intrigued. And essentially what happens is, you know, one of the main findings of the study was when someone has made their initial sort of gut reaction as to whether or not they want to buy or sell a company, if you present them with new information that was designed to be useless, but it's new information, the more information you give them, which is, again, designed to not further the decisions as to whether they should buy or sell the company, so it's useless new information, the more pieces of useless information you give them, the more confident people get in their original position. So where I see the corollary is all these people doing their own research, right? So I did my own research. Or think about anyone who's vested in Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. Everyone has that one friend or multiple that is just like a crypto head, and they spend a lot of time reading a lot of stuff. They may not know how to interpret it. And even if they did, if that information that they're consuming all the time, just by the very fact that they're consuming more information, which may or may not actually be useful information, is making them more entrenched in their original positions, is pretty reflective of what we're seeing around us. And so people are being very, very confident, but not necessarily making the right choices all the time. So that's why I was fascinated by that paper.
It's that confidence bias, right? It's hubris. When you've made a decision or when you've made a commitment, it's very hard to undo that commitment level in a way, right? I mean, and then when conflicting information comes your way, you tend to dismiss it, and anything that comes your way that confirms it is what sticks.
Yeah. And again, going back to the specific finding of this paper, just by virtue of looking at more information, you think that you're becoming more informed. You may not actually be becoming more informed. You're just becoming more confident. And, you know, one other thing I'll point out when it comes to overconfidence in general, there are actually ways that people measure the level of overconfidence that people have. And that is the difference between their perceived knowledge and their actual knowledge. And so in some of academic research, people have, you know, given investment literacy tests to people after they've asked them, hey, how well do you think you understand investing? And so they self-rate themselves. Oh, well, you know, I spent a lot of time on, I don't know, Wall Street Bets or whatever. And so therefore, I have a high level of investing literacy. And then you give them an actual test of investing literacy. And if they perform very low, then that delta is a proxy for overconfidence. And if their actual knowledge matches their perceived knowledge, then that's not overconfidence. They may actually know themselves very well. And one of the important sort of adages in our business is investor, know thyself. So the more you can understand yourself, both what you're good at and your limitations, that tends to bode well for your investing performance. Because if you know you don't know things, maybe you seek advice.
So do you find that that's the solution is like, I mean, under what circumstance would you have the opportunity to run those tests, right?
Yeah.
If more information doesn't actually improve the decision, what is it that does sort of intuitively make a difference?
Yeah, you should try to red team yourself. I don't know if you're familiar with that concept, but it arose during... The Cold Era, where the Red Team was basically the Soviet Union. And when it came to wargaming strategy, you basically would try to assume that you were the commander of, you know, the Soviet Union, and you were trying to poke holes in your strategy. And so that's where this idea of red teaming came from. That's where the red comes from. But basically, it's being adversarial to your own thinking. And so there's a couple ways that you can do that. You can just try and go out and try to disprove yourself. Just play devil's advocate. Find someone that you can talk to who is maybe a bit more of a curmudgeon. We all know one of those. But gets you to really challenge your thinking. And if you can't do that, at least try to do it yourself. And if you give it an honest try, that's the one antidote to sort of this phenomenon.
Preet, how many times do you think somebody has to go through the process of finding out how wrong they were before they... before they realize that they need to do something like red teaming.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we could come up with an analogous Feynman test, right? Like, how long does it take you to realize that you really don't know as much as you might think you do, and you have to engage this protocol of always being your own devil's advocate all the time? And the sooner you come to that realization, maybe the more wise you are as an investor.
Yeah, or maybe how much money do you have to lose before you realize that doing the same thing over and over again is going to result in a different result, you know, a different outcome?
Well, that might be a great dovetail into our next item that you want to talk about.
There was another great piece that you did on how people remember their own portfolio's past performance. And it turns out that memory isn't really pulling from the actual record. And we think it is, but it just isn't, right? Can you walk us through what that research actually found?
Yeah, it was pretty simple, really. The technical term that they describe is what's called a cue recall simulation loop, in that the cue is what is happening around us. And so if the market's going up, we tend to recall previous times when the market went up, and that makes us a little bit more exuberant and optimistic, and so we're more likely to buy. If markets are going down, it tends to cue the recall of previous times when the markets went down and we got burned and we're more likely to sell. And so this has an impact in that, you know, how we remember our past returns is not really reflective of the actual market returns or what even we experienced over the long period of time. In fact, you know, you could ask your clients or even ask yourself, hey, what do you think the returns were for the last 5 years? And most people are going to be quite wrong. And so this is a problem, because this then informs how we forecast the future. And one of the things that we can do is an antidote to this selective recall of market performance and our own personal performance is to actually create some kind of journaling process where, when we are thinking about our portfolio or thinking about, hey, should I sell or buy, or the markets have got me worried, is to actually write that down in a journal. That's not going to be of any benefit in the moment. The benefit is down the road when you've got a couple of years worth of these writings, and you can look with the benefit of hindsight to see what happened afterwards. But you can see your initial emotional reaction to what you thought was going to happen, and then how things panned out. And the more data that you have over a number of years, the more you might realize just how little we know in terms of how our emotions equate to future returns. So I thought that was a great sort of takeaway in terms of what to do about the selective memory recall, is to actually institute a process. I mean, that's the one thing we have control over, is the processes that we have. We can't guarantee outcomes, but we can guarantee processes that allow us to at least be in a position to make better long-term decisions with our money.
Looking at the way the industry has evolved, you know, there's still, of course, you know, the active investment avenue where people take the decisions, all the decisions of their, you know, their investment decisions, their money decisions into their own hands, and, you know, assume they're making good decisions as they go along. But then there's this whole school of evidence-based and rules-based investing and systematic investment that, you know, takes complex strategies and wraps them up into ETFs or mutual funds and does it for you. And people are torn between those two choices. They either can't decide, you know, am I really the person who can control the outcomes that happen to me or that happen in the market? Or am I the person who concedes and, you know, throws in the towel and says, you know, why am I even trying to pick stocks or funds or ETFs? When there are people who are a lot smarter than me, or processes that are a lot more unbiased and objective and will make those decisions without batting an eye. You know, it's the same reason we hire advisors, it's the same reason we hire realtors. It's to take the emotion out of the picture, so that, you know, we're not fighting for a better price because we love our home, our current home, so much that, you know, if we don't get an extra, you know, $20,000 for the sale, it's gonna change our lives.
Yeah, and I think
but we get hung up on things, right?
Yeah, I think you know, from my own research, one of the things I looked at was the fact that not all sources of advice, particularly financial advisors, are homogenous, and not all investors or clients are homogenous. I think a lot of the research historically, even today, is kind of framed as, you know, investors fit into this one generic bucket, but people are so different, you know, whether they're clients or advisors. And one of the things that we, I don't think give enough attention to is the fact that there is an entertainment aspect to investing that pulls people to varying degrees, you know, and a lot of people in this industry, they are excited about the world of investing for various reasons. Some like, you know, the roller coaster nature of it. Some like the high stress, the high pressure. Some just love numbers and spreadsheets and graphs. Some are very super analytical and try to be stoic and what have you. But for a lot of clients and investors out there, there is a varying level of entertainment that we want from our investors. Some people don't want it at all. They see, you know, personal finance management and wealth management as a pain, like going to the dentist. And other people, they look for advisors who are going to almost stoke those emotions that they're reaching for. And they can probably find them out there because, again, not all advisors are built the same way. So, yeah, I think that's one of the things from my personal research that I tried to tease into was the fact that, yeah, not all sources of advice are the same. You got to treat them differently. And not all clients are the same. Some clients, you know, you probably remember back when you were advisor, were a dream to deal with. And you could not wait to have a meeting with certain people. And there are certain households where you saw a pop up on your camera and it's like, oh, boy, I just got to get through this.
Absolutely. You're 100% correct there. You know, what is the math? What is the mathematical proportion of how people remember? Because I think it speaks to the distortion that we've talked about, the distortion in memory that people have. But is it two or three times or four times more intense when remembering losses versus remembering gains?
There might have been in that research when looking at past market experiences. I can tell you that, you know, when it comes to loss aversion in general, we're generally twice as sensitive to losses of the same magnitude as gains. I don't remember off the top of my head from that research what the delta was for recall of past experiences, but I imagine if I were to guess, it would be the same or higher, only because when you get stung, it really sits with a lot of people. And but again, I think it would also depend on when you started investing, because your initial investment experience and what happens in the market in your portfolio when you get started also becomes a bit of an anchor for the rest of your investing career.
Yeah.
You know, if you start right when things drop off the table, you get scarred. And you might chronically underinvest in equities for the rest of your life because you never want to replicate that feeling because your first experience is very indelible. Whereas people who, you know, their first investment was, I don't know, March of 2009, and things only went up from there, you're like, yeah, this investing is easy. What are you guys talking about? Like, I'll just keep on throwing more money into it. But both of those initial sort of reference points can torque how we look at investing over a lifetime.
We just simply don't realize how distorted our views can be.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way to actually correct for it, or is it just kind of baked in?
Yeah, I think in terms of mitigating the effect, the journaling of how you are feeling when you're thinking about your portfolio or markets, and writing that down and taking the time to really flesh out what is going on in your head, with the view that one day I'm going to look back on this and I want to be able to get some information out of what I was thinking, what happened at the time, and now with the benefit of hindsight, looking back at how things panned out, whether or not those emotions were valuable and what I learned about myself because of that. And some people might find that, you know, I don't know, maybe they're hardcore contrarians and it served them well and it might reinforce that. I think more people might find that their emotions get in the way of doing, sticking to a disciplined process.
I think I'm just thinking, you know, in the context of advisors working with their clients, I mean, you mentioned journaling before. that's something obviously people can do very, you know, individuals can do personally is journal their experience with investing. But I see an opportunity where advisors can actually, because of technology today, because of a lot of the AI tools that are coming into the fintech space for advisors to use, there's a really great opportunity to journalize all your meetings. I mean, I think people are already doing that, is to, you know, the note-taking function is to diarize or journalize all of those meetings where the client had a reaction or expressed strong emotions about something in their portfolio that happened. And if you keep track of it, you can take them back to that moment and say, you know, you felt pretty strongly about this 3 years ago. What's changed?
Yeah.
Right. So that could be a very powerful tool for advisors to help with their clients with their behavioral, you know, against their behavioral risk.
You know, I think we're going to build that app and put it into the advisor app store. So, I mean, that's one of the benefits of technology is that we can build apps and prototype them really quickly. And when people come up with great ideas like that, we can build that in less than a month and put it in the app store. So I think it would be great for advice, because I've heard of other advisors periodically in the past tell me about, you know, at the beginning of every year, they almost play a little game with their clients and say, hey, what do you think is going to be the ending value of, you know, the TSX, the S&P 500? Make some predictions. And it's mostly to show them how wildly bad we are at predicting. And over a series of years, you can come back and say, yeah, see, we really don't know what's going to happen in any short time frame over 1 year. But if we take a look at the financial plan, we are tracking in the right direction. We make changes when necessary, et cetera. And it helps pull them out of looking at the day-to-day and more towards looking at the long-term plan. Again, the process as opposed to the short-term outcomes.
Fascinating stuff, Preet. I'm going to want to see that app prototype.
Sure. Yeah, no problem.
Now, you connected something pretty personal, and I related to it, I think, you know, which was the idea of getting curious to an album, you know, a new album because of the parental advisory sticker.
Right.
You know, and you know, you connected that to a real body of research on how warnings can backfire.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the mechanism there? Like, why would telling someone this is risky sometimes make them want to do it more? There's lots of examples out there. There's some glaring ones that I can think of, you know, that have been in the pharmaceutical space, but.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, for me, so this research was looking at how, as you mentioned, warnings can have, they can backfire and have the opposite to the intended effect, can actually attract people to that thing that you're warning them about. And I think for a lot of people, you know, if you think back, you know, if you're a certain vintage, like myself, Gen X, of going into a music store, Sam the Record Man, whatever it is, and you see the albums and they had that big black and white sticker that says parental advisory or explicit lyrics or whatever it was. And it made it more seductive or desirable in some way. It was almost like a badge of being cool. And so it had the exact opposite intended impact of what the people who were trying to warn against people listening to this music wanted. And so I thought, yeah, you know, this is exactly something we need to be worried about in the investment world, because again, more and more people are opening up OEO platform accounts, order execution only, which is do-it-yourself platforms. Right. And what is our solution to them being able to sign a bunch of paperwork that says, yeah, I absolved you of all risk that I'm taking on. I can take crazy amounts of risk in this account without oversight because there's no advice allowed on those platforms. What do? We rely on disclosure and warnings, and those warnings go unheeded. And in some cases, maybe they actually attract people to certain financial instruments. So yeah, having a warning label or any type of warning draws attention to it in the first place. So some people say, oh, why are you warning me about this? Second, when we get exposed to people using those instruments, for example, on social media, and they're all documenting only the highlights. They don't tend to tell you about the times they lost 100% of their money within a risky strategy or instrument. They are telling you all the time, it's like, oh yeah, you can sell
puts on this stock instead of buying it is then just collect some money. Of course, they don't tell you what happens if it hits a strike price and you're on the hook for it. And so a lot of people say, yeah, I can do that too. And if you see enough people documenting only their wins, then those warnings become muted in your mind. They're like, well, these warnings are hyperbolic. And then the third thing is, again, in the case of the music albums and also when it comes to investing, let's say I wanted to buy one of those albums that had a parental advisory warning on it. I would just take that album up to the counter and the counter person would not ask me, hey, has your parent talked to you about this? No one ever checked, right?
Yeah.
And so, and who is the person who should be checking? In the case of an OEO platform, they're not allowed to give advice. And I mean, it is against their profit-seeking motives to prevent people from executing trades. So there's not a lot of incentive for them to police those warnings. And so we might be relying on people to just police themselves. And that doesn't seem to be a good strategy.
I think there's a lot of proof points that it doesn't work. I mean, if you look at, you know, you just compare that to or connect it to online gambling. I mean, what is stopping people from, you know, blowing their brains out online, gambling, playing poker, slots, what, you know, at least slots, yeah, you can play for a much longer time, but some of those, you know, some of those online card games, you could really lose your shirt.
Well, have you seen, did you hear that story about, there's this prediction market scam?
Well, that too, yeah.
Where this investor, I use investor in loose quotes, was making bets on the daily temperature highs in Paris.
Yeah.
And what they did was they manipulated, they found which sensor was the official sensor record that was used for clearing the bet. And it was a sensor at Charles de Gaulle Airport. And he found the sensor, he took a hairdryer, and so he'd place a bet that, you know, the temperature would hit 28 when the average was, you know, like 21 or whatever. And he'd just take his hairdryer and heat up the sensor till it hit that number, and then, you know, ended up making, you know, tens of thousands of euros on these manipulated bets. So, yeah, I don't know. It just seems like the wild, wild west out there when it comes to some of these instruments that are now being more readily available to everyday investors.
It's not as though the warnings aren't there. I mean, you know, like if you look at, like, for example, here, the, you know, the OLG, the Ontario Lottery Corporation, you know, the warnings are everywhere.
Mm.
Gambling is this, gambling is that, you could lose money. We see that obviously that, you know, across the prospectuses and everything else, where that kind of risk exists. But so it's interesting that it has, you know, it runs the risk of being, you know, like reverse psychology. Is there a type of warning that doesn't backfire? Like, is there a version that actually works?
That I might look to Europe, where they do have some semblance of an investment literacy test that you take when you open up certain brokerage accounts with certain providers. And if you get too many questions wrong in terms of your basic knowledge of different investment products, they won't allow certain products to be transacted on in your accounts. It's from what I understand, it's not a super rigid test. And the way it's enforced, I think, is more principles-based as opposed to being very prescriptive. But it is a step, I think, in the right direction. You know, if someone had to take a basic test, even if it's multiple choice on answering questions about how options work and what happens if your trade goes the wrong way and how much you might be on the hook for, and you get a lot of those answers wrong, I think it is wholly appropriate to deny access to trading in those investments because of the risk of investor harm. Whether we will see that in the future, 5 years ago, I would have said seems unlikely. I think the appetite for it is growing because I think we are realizing that the investing world has changed so much and how much people do on their own and turn to substitutes for traditional financial advice. So instead of a human financial licensed advisor, people are turning to community forums, online, social media, and what have you. And we recognize that the advice there, the variation in quality is massive. And so this is a problem where maybe these types of restrictions and tests, there's maybe a bit more appetite than there would have been even 5-10 years ago. So that might be something that we see on the horizon. And I think I am pretty much for that because, yeah, if you don't know how to answer those questions, maybe we are saving you from yourself. And if you take the time to learn how to do it, that's great. That means you're a more empowered, more literate investor and buyer beware, which I think is how we are operating, but we're not providing enough safeguards for people who are most vulnerable.
You ever feel like, you know, between capital markets, like writ large, and legislators and regulators, is there a fine line that, like, or a sweet spot, or somewhere in the middle where they don't want to cross a line because they feel there's a concern, like, let's say from the capital markets side, that too many warnings might be too restrictive of, you know, the wheels turning, the you know, the wheels being greased adequately, that suddenly, like, you know, these regulations came in and, you know, the machine came to a halt, or the machine slowed down, that politically would motivate, you know, all the stakeholders from sort of omitting to go that far.
Yeah, 1,000%. And part of the issue is that, you know, our long continuous border with the United States is a market with, I think, has seen a more relaxed approach to regulating certain types of behaviors. And to a certain extent, people are going to look to the South and say, well, why isn't that here? And look at the profits. And there's a lot of lobbying pressure. People look at the potential revenues. What does that mean for tax revenue? So on and so forth. And I think this has been, this is where it gets tricky, right? Because when you take a look at sports betting, there have been some regulatory and legal changes in the last little while that allowed us to see what the ultimate impact of this has been. And there's some pretty landmark papers that came out a couple of years ago that basically said, yeah, it's as bad as you thought. There's a substitute from retirement savings that goes into sports betting. And so they've seen, because in the US, you have 50 states and not all of them have online sports betting, and some of them did. So you're actually able to see the difference to the behavior. And it was almost like a, almost like an experimental design in a sense. So you could actually speak to causality, not just correlation. And what they saw was, yeah, in the states where online sports betting was made available, and looking across the border to states where it wasn't, there was a marked difference in how much people save for retirement through traditional investments, and went down, and is replaced by sports betting. Their credit scores went down if they had access to sports betting. Rates of default went down. All the bad things you can think of, they all in fact happened. So yeah, there's pressure, especially when it comes to different jurisdictions, and when you see something happening south of the border, then you know there's going to be pressure for that to happen in Canada. So it's a very tough balancing act for regulators and legislators, for sure.
Does it matter who's delivering the warning? Like, does it land differently when it's coming from a friend versus a financial institution?
It's a good question. You know, if you think about, you know, just to within our own households, you know, if my wife makes a recommendation or a warning, and then someone who is a friend of ours makes the same recommendation or warning, all of a sudden it lands differently, right? So there's probably something to that, especially when my wife then turns to me, that's what I've been saying all along. So I imagine that there is something to that. You know, if you assume that a warning that is prescribed by law or a regulator is there, that they're just doing what they're supposed to do, maybe that lands less effectively than warnings that come from somewhere else. Like, for example, you know, even influencers who get that name because they do influence behavior for better or worse.
So there was a study that you covered about robo-advisors, that the more human and warm the interface feels, the worse people's actual investing behavior gets.
Yeah.
That seems almost backwards. Like what's going on there?
Well, I think what's happening is that when people select into a robo advisor, they initially were looking at it as this nondescript tool. You know, it's purely utilitarian for executing transactions. What is interesting is that, you know, in the study they looked at, basically it was like a chatbot interface. And the more humanized they made this chatbot guidance, like giving it a name, maybe a face or a picture that looked human, the more human-like it got, the more people did not follow its advice or guidance. And I think what's happening here is there are some people who will choose a service that is, again, designed to be more of just a purely functional tool to free them from the psychological baggage of human interaction. And there's two things. And this was, I remember when I was doing my doctoral studies, there was another person in my cohort doing some research in the medical field. And in that field, there's a big emphasis on adherence, prescription adherence. So for example, if you diagnose someone with a certain condition, you know what the fix is, you prescribe them, you know, take these two pills every day and call me in 2 weeks or whatever. Well, if they don't follow the advice, that's going to impact their outcome. So advice adherence is a big thing. And two of the big factors that impact advice adherence is judgment anxiety and disclosure anxiety. So disclosure anxiety is you don't want to take off your clothes in front of the doctor. Judgment anxiety is you don't want to the fear of being judged for having made bad personal decisions with respect to your health or what have you. Same thing with money. You know, there can be a reluctance to disclose everything that you have in terms of your assets, liabilities, mistakes, or lack of net worth that you think that you should be having at this stage in your life and for fear of judgment. And so that might impact the nature of the relationship as to why some people will say, well, yeah, just give me a tool. Because then I don't have to worry about disclosing things to a human. It's just the robot. It's cold and calculating. That's all it does. But as soon as you start making more humanized, all of a sudden you bring in that psychological baggage of human interaction. So I thought that was a fascinating
look
into that aspect of financial psychology.
You can apply it to why millennials and Gen Z, you know, newer investors, younger investors would automatically gravitate to these OEO platforms, right? Because there isn't the existential questions being asked, you know, what's your net worth? Who are you? What do you do? You know, what do you need to know all that? I just want to trade some stock. You know?
Well, yeah, I think the other factor is speed. Yeah. Like for them, it's like, get out of the way and let's get into the markets here. You know, let's trade. Let me push the online buttons myself. This is way too slow the way you do it with a human, right? So I think there's multiple reasons why younger investors might be gravitating towards OEO. Sometimes it's just because of a lack of trust with the industry. You know, they grew up in an era where they witnessed the great financial crisis and the bailing out of the people who took all the risk. And it was basically socialized losses. So the way that they look at the industry is quite a bit different than I think that parents' generation too. So a lot of reasons for that, I think.
But at some point, I mean, if you're talking about those younger investors, I think there's a point in time where, you know, they're not, I really liked your insights on disclosure and judgment risk. I think those are really interesting touch points, because when you look at, you know, the disclosure side, you almost like the two go hand in hand at that point, right? If you don't want to disclose that, you know, you've only got 20 grand to invest, but maybe you think you should have more, then the disclosure also sort of dovetails into the judgment. It's like, why don't you have more money saved? Or why aren't you a better saver? Then it's like mom and dad, right? And I don't want to hear that if I'm 20, you know, if I'm 25, I don't want to hear that I should be doing more. I should be, you know, I should have developed better habits and brush my teeth, you know, 3 times a day.
And I think this is why a contemporary financial advisor, financial planner, a larger and larger part of their business is understanding human behavior and psychology. I've long said that personal finance is 90% psychology and 8% math. And the missing 2% underscores how unimportant the math is, because it's really all about psychology.
You know, when you consider all the things that people get hung up on when it comes to investing, their portfolios and, you know, fees, like, well, not the NSF fees, but like ETF, you know, fees, mutual fund fees, that competition that has occurred over the last 20 years, you know, where we've had this race to the bottom, you know, for what investments cost, like buying an index fund for 3 basis points versus an actively managed fund for over 1%. You know, when you the industry has boiled it down to, you know, making these investments the lowest cost possible, these index funds in particular, and people have gotten hung up on those ideas. I can buy the whole market for almost free. The biggest risks are actually the behavioral risks, to your point, which is that the psychology and what you, you know, how you behave in the market, how you behave with your portfolio is more important than what it costs, because those behavioral risks are an order of magnitude potentially more significant than the fees. That doesn't solve the problem of what are you going to do when the market's down 20, 30, 40%. Are you going to get out because you're scared and write a permanent loss? Or are you going to stay the course and ignore?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the themes of my columns over the last, I'd say, 2 to 3 years has been challenging the idea that democratization of investing is always a good thing. There's certainly cases where, you know, you can say, yes, it's increased financial inclusion. So people who didn't have access to capital markets before, smaller investors, now have unfettered access to capital markets. But there's a lot of research that says, yeah, but not all this democratization is good. You know, the fact that account minimums are now literally a dollar in some brokerages. There's a study that looked at that becoming an anchor for people. So they start small and they stay small, meaning that because they can open up an account with a small amount of money, they get anchored to contributing a small amount of money because that's what they started with. And no one is there to intervene and say, you know, let's get that saving number up because now you're making more money. You should be putting more money into your long-term portfolio. So there's an anchoring effect with these low investment minimums. And then we have, you know, fractional share trading, commission-free trading. And one of the landmark studies has been, you know, how trading is hazardous to your wealth, right? The Barber Nordine study. And what we're seeing is that we have all these innovations and features that are leading to more trading activity, which tends to be associated with lower risk-adjusted returns.
Yeah. Reminds me of the Dalbar study, right? Which is that the investments outperform the investors.
Yeah, I will say with the Dalbar study, though, that I think they are directionally correct. From what I understand, there's some serious methodological concerns about those numbers. But notwithstanding that, I do think that directionally there is a cost to behavior. And behavior, by the way, impacts both investors and advisors. And then there is the intersection of that as well, which all comes down to basically saying that it's really all about psychology, you know?
which is your overarching,
yeah,
right, your overarching premise. Lastly, Preet, there's the research on when advice actually lands. That people are more receptive to a recommendation after they've already formed some opinion of their own. How did you come across that? And does it match with what you've seen in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And so basically what happened is there's this study that looked at performing tasks, making a decision. And in some cases, people were provided with advice to follow before being presented with, information for them to dig
digging into. And in other cases, they were allowed to sort of come up with their own analysis first and then receive the advice. And so if the advice was identical, it was perceived differently depending on whether or not people had actually noodled the idea themselves. And if they had, they valued the advice a lot more. And I thought that was fascinating because if you think about it, you know, let's say someone is deciding, you know, I should probably learn how to invest. They go online, they go to some Reddit threads, they read up about investing, and very quickly they become overwhelmed. But they have a base level of knowledge and some kind of reference point. And so when they go and then they speak to a professional advisor, it can validate what they were thinking or it can challenge them, but they'll know a little bit more about why they're being challenged on that. And it'll make more sense to them. So they're able to actually judge the value of the advice better when they have some frame of reference. And where I think this is really important is in this world of AI and ChatGPT and Claude and whatnot, because more and more clients are fact-checking their advisors or turning to ChatGPT for financial advice. And I think a lot of people are worried about that. And what I think is there's actually an opportunity here. Because if your client says to you, well, ChatGPT said this or that, I think there's a real risk in becoming very adversarial off the bat. They're going to do it whether you like it or not. And if you tell them that you don't like it, they're just not going to tell you that they're doing it the next time that they do it.
Yeah, they'll go underground.
Yeah, and what you want is a more collaborative relationship. So if they are, in fact, using ChatGPT or whatever AI service to ask some of these questions about their financial situation, this is great because now they have some frame of reference so that when they talk to you, they are going to value your advice more. You're going to be able to get to a recommendation or strategy for them to consider more quickly. And the perceived value of your advice will be higher. That was one of the takeaways from that study. And so, yes, I'm sure there will be some people who say, well, I don't need an advisor at all. I'm just going to use ChatGPT. I don't think that's going to be the vast majority of people anytime soon. There will be some people who do that for sure. I think there's going to be far more people who are going to use, and I just use ChatGPT generically, who use ChatGPT and then still talk to their advisor. But this study says that that's actually going to lead to a higher perceived value in your advice because now they have a better frame of reference. You can also use the opportunity to help educate clients on AI literacy. Which is now becoming a bigger part of financial literacy because there is a new source of information. And we know that there's situations where it hallucinates, doesn't always give the optimal answer, et cetera. And so when it comes to things like, you know, figuring out terminology for them to help understand what you're saying, great use of AI and ChatGPT. The more irreversible a decision is, the less you'll want them to rely on the output. So for example, you know, if they ask ChatGPT about commuting their pension and it says, well, you should do X, Y, or Z, and you do that, it's a pretty irreversible decision. So you want to let them know how and when to use ChatGPT to actually lead to a better relationship with them because they're going to maybe come to a meeting more prepared. There's going to be less time spent going over the basics before you get to the meat of the discussion. More of the discussion is going to be the meat because they'll be a little bit more prepared. So I think this is part of the paradigm shift that we're going through. And I think advisors are probably better placed to embrace this change and figure out how to work with it as opposed to push back on it. Because if you do, you're just going to push away your clients.
Thanks, Breed.
Thank you, as always, for the opportunity to share this time with you and with your listeners. I appreciate it. And hopefully I'll be back soon.